6 past the hour on Air America Radio, and this is Morning Sedition.
Good morning, geniuses, philosopher, kings and queens, everybody out there who feels okay today. Good morning to you. If you're bitter or self-pitying or angry, you know, good morning to you, too. I mean, I feel a little of that, but I feel relatively good this morning, Mark Riley.
I feel great, man. Good morning.
Good morning to you. I still got a little post-meal buzz on. I'm a little giddy and a little tired. You see, Riley and I and P.W. McDonald and Dan Pashman, Son of Lewis, and Linda Pashman were the guests of Alan Richman and
yes.
Danielle Balloud
yes.
from the restaurant Danielle, which is a very high-end French restaurant here in New York City.
So high-end, you really have to get on an elevator to see the top. I mean, you can't even see the food when they bring it in.
Alan Richman is our food guy, the guy who wrote Fork It Over. He's been in a couple of times. Very fun guy. And, well, he took us to dinner at what he thinks is really the best restaurant in New York. And we got, you know...
You'll get no argument from me now. That they actually saw me, moi, as a challenge.
Well, they did because, you know, you're like, you can eat four things. You're like, I like dry white turkey, macaroni and cheese,
that's right.
And lobster.
Yeah.
So, you know, they had to work around it.
Yeah, but you know what? They managed to hit all of my basic food groups.
They tried some stuff, man. And, like, we were there late because, you know, 8:30 is late for us. We were getting, like, I didn't get home until 10 o'clock, which is late for us.
Real 10 late
o'clock
for us.
East Coast time.
But we're all up now.
Listen to what we ate, man. This is for you. If you're just having breakfast, just getting up, this is what we had last night.
Yeah.
Yellowfin tuna a la plancha. Trilogy of celery, black truffle, and mache. I don't even know what that is. But it was good. Grilled Nantucket Bay scallops, artichoke, black truffle, and watercress. That was amazing.
Scallops to die for.
The scallops are like they just melt in your mouth. Scallops. Sorry,
yeah.
Caleb. Are you bumming out? How's your cup of noodles, Caleb? You enjoying the cup of noodles?
I'm eating cup of noodles, and you're eating truffles and all this.
Sorry you couldn't make it. I mean, there just wasn't enough room at the table. Next time, you're going to come.
Doggy bag? Did anyone bring a doggy bag?
Oh, like there was anything left over. What, are you kidding me?
No, people were bringing doggy bags into the restaurant.
Dude, I was still eating when everyone left. You know, Riley takes off to go home, and I'm like, hey, there's still chocolates here. He brought us into the kitchen, man.
This
kitchen is spotless. Everyone looks like a doctor. All right, Chris? And there's like 900 waiters there. Yeah, dude, you finish a course, like 50 guys converge on your table and practically lick it clean.
It's an armada they bring.
Here we go. Duo of Florida frog legs, fricassee with porcini and garlic croutons, crispy with... What's that? Aioli, right?
Yeah.
And romaine lettuce.
I didn't eat that part.
The frog legs were awesome. And I'm not a big amphibian either. All right? But the frog legs, you know, I'd never eaten them before, but they were tasty. Riley had the warm smoked lobster with an herbed crust.
Yeah.
Sage Royale.
Yeah.
Bacon lentil ragu.
Yeah.
And a sauce cardinal.
I didn't eat the bacon lentil ragu because, of course, I don't eat bacon. But the lobster... was unbelievable. That whole smoke thing, man.
So beautiful, too. Everything was so beautiful. What does this have to do with anything? Hey, this is a political show. Not today. Today it's
Food Network.
It's food follow-up. Look at this. Oh, this is good. Loup de mer baked in salt crust, turnip sauerkraut, glazed baby carrots, and bacon pepper jus. Chris, they brought out the whole fish.
Yeah, the whole thing, it was smoking. He cut it open and removed the salt crust outer shell, then removed the skin off of that. I mean, just, it was unbelievable.
Took it back, sliced it up, put it on the plate.
Yep.
And then we had the quartet of Neiman Ranch pork, crispy belly, roasted tenderloin, braised shank, and homemade truffled pork sausage.
I didn't have that.
No, I know you didn't. Here's what you had. Papu, I don't even know how to pronounce this, but it was good.
Yeah,
Papuette. Of black sea bass and a crisp potato shell with tender leeks and Syrah sauce. That was some nice looking stuff.
Was that the wine reduction sauce?
Yeah,
wine reduction sauce was just really unbelievable.
Then we had a whole roasted guinea hen with black truffle cocotte. I'm bad at this.
Yeah.
Of root vegetables. This was, hey Chris, I'm sorry, I have a couple of noodles, all right? Okay. So the hen with Clutch Larson in there with a bag of peppers.
Yeah.
Dude, they crispy roasted this hen, and under the skin...
The truffles!
Layers of black truffles, dude.
Yeah.
Layers of black truffles under the skin. What kind of cup of noodle you got? What is it?
Chicken,
yeah.
That's good.
Not hen, though.
You got a bunch of that, right? You bought a box at Costco or something?
Yeah.
That's good. That's great.
Could be rooster.
And Top Ramen.
Oh, good for you. But not because you can't afford it. It's just because you like them, right? So you probably forgot.
Yeah.
You were happy.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, that's it. No,
hey, man, this guy is
ramen noodles.
He eats that ramen, but then he travels all over the world.
Yeah.
So don't feel bad for him.
No, I'm not
yeah.
feeling bad for him. I'm just sharing our experience
wow.
last night. So then, okay.
Thanks for sharing.
Seasonal fruit desserts and chocolate desserts. They brought out every dessert they make at the place. Chocolate mousses, homemade ice creams.
I had a thing. I swear to God, I've never seen anything like this before.
Yeah.
It was like one of those it was like Rice Krispies on the bottom. With peanut ice cream
yeah.
on top of that, and then a chocolate congealed chocolate top to it.
Unbelievable! And then all these homemade chocolates. I brought you some pretzels today, Chris. Did you see the bag of pretzels I got?
Yeah, thanks.
Thanks a bunch. They came from Daniel, sure.
And then after Riley's getting ready to go, out comes the creme brulee.
Yeah.
Three kinds, a sampling, 12 little things of creme brulee, and the madeleines, hot baskets of madeleines.
I did have a madeleine. I'm not a big creme brulee fan, but I mean, it was like the parade of creme brulee.
Dude, I felt like, you know, I didn't know how to behave. It felt like I was around royalty or something. I get very intimidated at French restaurants, like there's protocol. And well, anyway, so we recorded the whole thing. And
we're going to bring it to you.
If this did anything for you, then you're going to like the 3 hours that we got talking to these guys while we're eating.
And we were under a canopy. I mean, we were in almost a separate room within the restaurant. And tell them about the skybox.
Oh, yeah. Well,
skybox.
The skybox.
Daniel Ballud, the chef who owns the place, in the kitchen, which is spotless.
Yeah.
Spotless, Kayla. Everything's silver. I mean, this thing is like you could...
It looks like the operating room at Lenox Hill Hospital.
You could, probably a little cleaner. You could eat off the floor at this place. All right? He's got above in the kitchen, up elevated in this separate area. You walk upstairs. He's got a skybox that looks over the kitchen. He's got like a flat screen TV where he eats with friends.
Yep.
The chef, man. He's got a skybox in his own kitchen. And he just sits up there and he eats and he shows he's got pictures.
And this is only for his special friends. See, it's one thing to be able to get into the restaurant, which I kind of figure, Mark, if you're able to go to Daniel and eat dinner, it's kind of like being invited into Studio 54 back in the day.
Dude, I can't even imagine what this meal would cost us. I can't even imagine. I mean, I don't want to knock it because you got to pay for the good stuff. I mean, this is high end. And I'll tell you, by the end of the meal, yeah, I was giddy. I was laughing.
Yeah.
I was plowing through Riley's creme brulee, but he doesn't like. All right, and one of them was almond, so Brendan couldn't eat it. So me and Passman are just sitting there plowing through everyone else's creme brulee, laughing like children.
Yeah.
Like children.
The wine was really good, too. The sommelier, what's his name, Philippe?
Philippe the sommelier.
He picked out some really, really great wine.
We did some high-class eating last night, Chris, and I was intimidated. I didn't feel like I deserved it. That's the weird thing. I didn't know how to be. I was worried that I wasn't behaving properly. And I can't drink, you know, because I'm sick. All right? So, so the Philippe, the guy kept coming with all these beautiful wines, and then I'm smelling them and stuff, and every time you go to pour my glass, I'm like, no, I can't. I have a problem. You know what I mean? And I didn't want... Good. Yeah, I'm
good.
Glad. but I kept saying to him, like, because I'd look at him and I feel like, because he's like, you know, these guys, they're like doctors, and I just imagine they spend, you know, years studying the wines and everything else, so every time he did it, because I can't drink, I'd look at him and go, it's so sorry, I got nothing to do with you. You're doing a great job.
You're a nice guy. But you know what?
Bottle.
The amazing thing, because I think the same thing you did. I really felt like at some point during this whole thing, that armada of waiters would come in and just tell us, well, you know, you'll have to leave now.
Yeah, okay? Yeah, I know.
It's like, time is up.
Or we did something wrong.
Yeah, we did something wrong. We insulted somebody. And you all are just going to have to get your coats and get the H out of here.
Committed some sort of weird sin. You ate with the wrong fork.
Yeah.
These guys wouldn't let you. I mean, the
fork would appear and disappear like Kreskin was in the house.
I'll tell you what, Kayla. I'll take you out for some fries today, French fries.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Thanks.
Is that right? Maybe some chicken wings or something?
Yeah, that sounds great.
Yeah.
Compared to your meal.
Yeah, you saw a bag of pretzels, everybody, right?
Yeah, thanks again.
Sure, man. We'll be talking about Iraq after this. It's 15 past the hour, Air America Radio.
Hi, this is Rob Corddry from The Daily Show, here to remind you that when top news reporters and investigative journalists like me want their news skewed so far to the left it's wearing a dress, we turn to Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Past the hour, Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Yep.
It's Morning Sedition. If you want to join the Morning Sedition Book Club and purchase Sam Lipsight's Homeland, you can go to morningsedition.com. He'll be back in the studio on January 28th to take your calls and discuss the book. If you'd like a little taste. You want a little taste? Here's a little taste.
Feeling is not quite the word for the feeling. How's bathing at knife point in the phlegm of the dead? Is that a feeling?
There you go. If you want to hear more of that, or the rest of that, this is a great book. It's darkly funny. It's like Catcher in the Rye in Hell. Almost. If you can imagine that. I'll be performing at Jimmy Tingle's Off-Broadway Theater in Davis Square, Somerville, Massachusetts, on Friday and Saturday, January 21st and 22nd.
This weekend.
You can go to the tour dates page from morningsedition.com for info and tickets. Someone asked me about whether I would be doing Jerusalem Syndrome one of those nights. You know, I hate to tell you, buddy, but the jury's still out. I mean, you'd think I would make a decision. I'm trying to... I know that one night I'm going to do stand-up, but I've been plowing this Jerusalem syndrome back into my head, Riley, and I haven't done it in a few years.
I know.
And it's almost all in my head. I should have it all in my head by Saturday. So if I'm going to do Jerusalem syndrome, it will be this Saturday show. Also, today it marks the first day of the confirmation hearings for Condoleezza Rice. We're going to talk about that soon, but we've got a guest coming up, David Enders, a freelance journalist and founder of Baghdad Bulletin, Baghdad's first English-language newspaper. He's going to be on the phone, so I think we should talk about a little bit about Iraq first.
Well, you know, there was some good news that came out of Iraq. I'm
sure it was bad news. It was bad news up until about 12 minutes ago.
Yeah, yeah. I'm sure most of you might have gone to bed last night knowing, if you watched the late news, that an archbishop, the Iraqi Catholic Archbishop of Mosul, was kidnapped yesterday. The Vatican called that an act of terrorism. Well, he has been freed. Archbishop Basil George Kazmusa of the Syrian Catholic Church was kidnapped by gunmen in Mosul. He has been freed. He is on his way home without paying any ransom, and that's according to an assistant to Archbishop Kazmusa.
You know what this means, Mark Riley?
Hallelujah?
It means don't with the Vatican.
With the Vatican, yeah. Well, you know, I have to say, I predicted the man would be free.
I got to say, you did. We had that story. We're sitting there doing the prep for the show, reading. He's like, this is going to be done in a day.
Yeah.
And I'm like, how'd you know that? Because you don't with the Vatican.
Yep, absolutely.
All right?
Just like I knew about Wayne Gilman's love life.
Yeah, you knew that was going to come around, too. You knew that Wayne Gilman was going to get back together with his lady friend on Martin Luther King's Day. You called it to the day.
Yeah.
Every once in a while you hit it, Riley.
Every
That's
now
the
and then. But no, it's good to hear this. You know, there was a ransom initially demanded, $200,000.
Yeah.
But, you know, and not to tie this directly into a local situation, but, you know, there was a very grisly and tragic murder of an entire family in New Jersey, in Jersey City. And apparently, at least according to some police reports and some media reports, at the center of this was the fact that the family was apparently a group of Egyptian Christians who had gotten into some beef with some other Egyptians. Who apparently were Muslim.
Hmm.
Now, there have been no arrests made or whatever, but it's just interesting that, you know, in Iraq, you have a Christian, you know, clergy person of pretty high rank kidnapped, and here you have an Egyptian Christian, again, a minority within the Egyptian community, and the whole family was murdered.
Yeah, we don't even, the details aren't in on that exactly, what was going on. It's been assumed that it was some sort of religious dispute.
That's what the police are saying. Now, they are still in the initial phases of their investigation. The funeral was yesterday, mm-hmm. and it was a very, very emotional situation because two of the victims were kids.
Yeah, awful. Christians make up just 3% of Iraq's 26 million people. And, you know, apparently, this is in this piece that I'm reading right in front of you. The Pope immediately changed his prayer to one of thanks.
Yes.
From what? From what? I mean, he changed his prayer to one of thanks to one of, like, you know, oh, I'd please hurt the people that did this. I guess it would be he changed it from one of hope, please return them. To one of thanks, not to see. I just
yeah. He had been praying for the bishops, for the archbishops'
for the
return, yeah.
Not the revenge. How come I always assume the worst?
Well, maybe you know he's probably saying, well, that's why I'm the Pope. You know,
he's got
pray
some serious
things happen.
He's got some serious magic, the Pope.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? The Catholic Church is some serious mystical stuff, man. I you know when I was in Italy, we went to a lot of churches. I saw a lot of dead wizards in glass boxes. I saw a lot of body pieces. I saw a lot of very ornate. I mean, I'll tell you something, man. You walk into some of those cathedrals there, some of the stuff, like even the one in Florence, the Duomo in Florence. I mean, I'm not a believer. You know, but you walk in and you look at just how much genius they use, you know, architecturally, you know, in terms of construction, in terms of the sculptures and the painting and everything else. And you walk in and it's like, oh, my God, you literally drop to your knees just out of the awe of such a structure. I'll tell you, the Catholics have got the magic down.
But, you know, what this kidnapping represents is the simple fact that in Iraq right now, no one, and I mean no one, is safe. It seems as though the United States military, which is charged, of course, with trying to keep people safe in the country, simply cannot do that job. We've gotten more reports of people dying.
With the election coming up, there's a big push in terms of they just assume that, you know, people are going to be attacked waiting to vote. You think Ohio was bad. Imagine waiting online for hours and then maybe like, oh, we're almost there.
Three people were killed when a suicide bomber detonated a car bomb outside the offices of Iraq's largest Shiite political party. And the problem with this, Mark, is that these attacks are now spreading to areas that the U.S. military had previously declared safe. Places that, you know, folks were supposed to be able to move around in. The attacks on journalists, the attacks on people who would ordinarily be considered removed from the straight-up fighting, they're starting to increase, and that's always very
scary. Nothing seems to stay safe for very long there, and I guess they're trying to make an assessment of the actual potential of ever getting out of Iraq in terms of, you know, how much success are they having. And in the past, we've heard that there wasn't much success in training Iraqi national security forces and in creating an atmosphere of loyalty to Iraq and to the American effort. Has been very unsuccessful because they know on some level the Americans are going to leave, and there's going to be, you know, sort of tribal bickering, and also they are going to be the marked enemies of the insurgents for their alignment with the Americans after the Americans leave. So the attempt to garner loyalty and some sort of discipline around this stuff has been very difficult.
Well, yeah, it's been difficult specifically because they're hedging their bets. They don't know who's going to win this election yet, and they don't know whether they'll be out of power if the wrong people win.
Well, now he's campaigning. It looks like he's like traveling around with a hit squad.
Ray!
Okay.
He's gone already. We'll be back with the Palm Pilot. He dropped it off. We're going to talk a little bit more about Iraq and so much more. If I ever get untongue-tied here on Air America Radio.
Mark Maron and Mark Riley, Morning's Edition on Air America Radio.
Past the hour, Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Yes.
You're listening to Morning Sedition on Air America. I will be at Jimmy Kingle's Off-Broadway Theater in Davis Square, Somerville, Massachusetts, Friday and Saturday this weekend, January 21st and 22nd. You can go to the tour dates page on morningsedition.com for info and tickets. We all went to Danielle last night, the greatest restaurant in the world. You're going to be hearing about that maybe next week. We'll get the whole thing together, sooner. Oh, yeah, and Kayla, I'm sorry you couldn't come, but I forgot to mention that there were three different kinds of creme brulee. That we had left. Yeah, three different kinds. Did you finish a cup of noodles, sir?
I finished a cup of noodles. I'm on to the pretzels.
You're a sadist, man.
I brought you the pretzels. That's
you
right.
Are a
those
sadist.
Those are those good pretzels you get over at the Green Market.
You are a sadist.
There was coffee creme brulee, toasted almond creme brulee.
Toasted almond?
Yeah.
I didn't even know that existed.
Burnt almond creme brulee. And then the other one, I forget. I think it was just called Heaven. I hear. It's weird. You know, was Ramon wearing a clerical collar? Was that? I mean, I
don't know. You know, I think he said something about the inauguration.
Well, as the inauguration approaches, one of the most important people is someone. What is that called? The priest's collar. Is it called a clerical
collar?
Is it called a vestment? Is it called you know, the little white? You don't know. I wouldn't know.
I don't know.
Well, presto. You grew up with that weird cult thing. What is it called?
You were close to God.
I have absolutely no idea.
Really?
A collar.
Well, we're gonna crunch those numbers back there. P.W. McDonald's a theology student. No one knows. It's got to be something in Latin. It's going to be good when we find out, though. I'm excited about
Clercus it. Clercus Collaris.
Yeah. All right, here we go. As the inauguration approaches, one of the most important people is someone you might not have heard of. Michael Gerson is Bush's speechwriter. He's a born-again evangelical who just can't help inserting religious language into W's speeches. Even though he had a mild heart attack last December, God must like him because he's back on his feet and hard at work. Here's Gerson's Palm Pilot for today. 5 a.m.
Wake up, pray, ask God for the patience to endure Bush when he says things like hopefuler or uninalienable rights. And is our children learning? 7 a.m. Revise speech. Make sure right-wingers know that the phrase ownership society does not mean we're bringing back slavery. 7:30 a.m. Comb Deuteronomy for any references to Social Security. 8:30 a.m. Work gospel lyrics into speech. I got shoes, you got shoes. All God's children got shoes. 10 a.m., work with Mr. Bush on revision to coded language, all right? Jacob's Ladder means flat tax. Water into wine means faith-based funds. Lot's wife means gay marriage ban. Parting the Red Sea, tort reform. 2 p.m., review address to make sure it contains no concrete plans. 5 p.m., call Jesus, ask for punch-up. On the phone right now, from Iraq, is a freelance journalist. He's the founder of the first English-language newspaper, the Baghdad Bulletin, which is now defunct. We'll ask him why. His book, The Baghdad Bulletin, comes out in April. His articles have appeared in Mother Jones and The Nation. David Enders is with us. Good morning, David.
Morning. How are you?
Very well. What's going on? We got news that an archbishop was kidnapped and released. Have you heard about that? What's happening on the streets of Iraq today, David?
I heard about that. That was up in Mosul, so I don't have anything firsthand on that. This morning there was a car bombing at one of the main Shiite political parties. Their office is not too far from our hotel down here, and also just happened driving through one of the southern neighborhoods to come upon a car bomb that had been rammed into a convoy of Iraqi National Guard troops.
Mm. So let me ask you a question about what your paper was, because I guess people don't really know you, and your buddy Anthony LaPay has been on the show many times. You went to Iraq to start the first free English-speaking newspaper, correct?
Correct.
And now why is that defunct, David?
Well, it was started by myself and a few British friends, and we found that sort of as the situation here got worse, it was very hard to find backers, and sort of our only option became, we got a lot of offers to turn it into sort of a business magazine, catering to companies making money off the reconstruction, and sort of for obvious reasons we declined to do that. People didn't seem terribly interested. We approached DFID, sort of the British equivalency of USAID, and people didn't seem terribly interested in funding an English language outlet. On the ground.
Okay.
Now, David Enders, tell us, if you would, what you know about reports we're getting here that the violence in Iraq has spread to what were previously viewed to be safe areas of the country.
Well, I'm not sure that there's ever been an area that's really been a safe area of the country. The resistance has always sort of shown an ability to strike virtually anywhere in the country. The safest areas, per se, are Basra in the south, which does seem to be fairly well controlled by some Shiite militias, and then the Kurdish area in the north. But the center of the country, I mean, even a year ago, you know, Karbala and Najaf, which are major Shiite cities sort of between Baghdad and Basra, those have been subjected to car bombs throughout, even before there was fighting in both of those cities between the U.S. and Muqtada al-Sadr's militia. It's hard to tell. Some people think that the resistance are actually looking at, you know, the news reports when American commanders say, oh, this area is safe enough, this area is safe enough, and then they're purposely going and striking there to sort of make a point. But there's never really been a truly safe area, an area that you know, the resistance couldn't strike in.
David, why does it seem as though we don't get a great deal of information about the insurgents trying to strike at the Kurds? At the Kurds. I mean, we hear about some violence in northern Iraq, but we rarely hear about any kind of attack against the Kurdish population.
Well, the Kurds, they've had an autonomous zone since 1991 when the no-fly zone was set up. And they've been allowed to keep their own security forces, and they are quite aggressive in you know, keeping people out. I was up there most recently last summer, and you know, you go through extremely tight security to go into that area. And then once you're in the area, there are checkpoints all over the place. And I was traveling with Iraqi Arabs, and at times, one of my friend's cars was actually impounded simply because he was an Iraqi Arab from Baghdad. And so they're very, very aggressive in their security.
Are you saying then that the American forces are decidedly less aggressive than the Kurds are in keeping areas secure?
No, I wouldn't say that. The Kurds are keeping a specific area secure. The Americans are sort of stuck with this, you know, whole area of central Iraq where you know, there's no front line. The Kurds have a very defined front line and a border that they're keeping people from crossing. And so they're able to defend that quite well, whereas the Americans never really have controlled, you know, the extremely large borders that they're forced to deal with.
We're getting reports that, you know, a lot of violence is going to be expected as we approach the elections, that they're going to be targeting polling places. Already are campaigns underway to frighten people. What is the interest level in the vote? Are people are going to vote despite of this, or is it working? Is the insurgents' plan to deter people from voting working? Are people disinterested in general? What's the tone on that, David?
It's really hard to tell. A lot of people do say they'll vote, but come election day, once attacks start happening, and you know, people are saying, "Well, I don't think on second thought, I'm not going to go to the polling place with my family." So I mean, that'll be something we really know about on election day. Most of what I hear when I talk to people who do say they will vote, you know, is that they hope that it's some small step, that maybe if they vote, that maybe this will put the country one step closer to writing the Constitution and maybe sort of legitimizing the government. But, a lot of people are very desperate. I think if you told Iraqis voting, you know, would keep the power on for 10 hours, they'd do it. Or if you told them dancing naked in the streets would keep the power on for 10 hours straight, they'd probably do that,
yeah,
too, a lot of them. And it's really, people don't really know who's running. You sort of press them when they say they'll vote, and you say, well, who are you going to vote for? And they don't even know who's running because most people haven't really publicly declared their candidacy. And it was recently announced by the Elections Commission, which, you know, less than 3 weeks before the election, less than 2 weeks now, has not released the names, the full names of the people who are running. So essentially, if people vote for a party, they don't necessarily know who they're voting for. And the Election Commission has now made the decision that they're under no obligation to release those publicly before the election. So people who vote are, in many cases, literally not going to know who they're voting for.
Well, they should try that here.
Right. It's a secret ballot.
Incredible. David,
so it's really sort of, it's tough to tell. I think, you know, widespread in sort of the so-called Sunni areas where the insurgency is the strongest, people aren't going to be voting, and in fact it doesn't even sound as though they're going to open polling stations. Muqtada al-Sadr has kind of come out in opposition to Ayatollah Sistani's stance on the vote, and really I think the only people you're going to see voting in the end are going to be people who are very sort of hardcore Sistani supporters.
So let me just, in closing here, we can pretty safely say from where you're standing that this vote, this election, is relatively meaningless in relation to the mass population of the country.
It's kind of analogous to the handover of power.
Okay.
That occurred last summer. You know, people just sort of shrugged and said, well, I hope maybe things will start to get better after this.
Right. Well, David Enders, thank you very much for joining us. We'll talk to you again soon, I hope.
All right. Thanks a lot.
Okay, thanks,
take
David.
It easy. He was good, man.
Well, you know, it's funny. Now, he's essentially saying that people are shrugging their shoulders at this election the way they shrugged their shoulders at the handover of power. You remember how, you know, the handover of power was done like in the dead of night, it almost seemed like, as far as we were concerned.
Sure, and you know, 70 million people in this country shrug their shoulders.
Yeah.
They really do. I mean, it's like, even if they did know who was voting, I mean, it's just an interesting thing about elections, but it's kind of fascinating in terms of the Iraqi elections that they've done
really nothing to educate the population in terms of how this might work or what an election means and what it means to them and who is running and what they stand for. I guess it's kind of hard to disseminate information when there are people with guns and bombs blowing things up everywhere and you have a hard time, you know, keeping a light on at night because you only get electricity for 10 hours a day. But it just seems that the information is not getting out there as to what impact this could have on your country.
Well, the United States, regardless, seems prepared to say this is legit.
Okay. We'll be back with Condoleezza Rice's confirmation hearings and much more on Air America Radio. It's 46 past the hour.
Morning Sedition. It's more than just a commute companion.
Listen online at morningsedition.com when you get to work. Courtesy of
Air America Radio.
Who are these people?
Morning Sedition.
On record is out. It's no secret anymore.
Morning Sedition from Air America Radio.
Pleased to announce my nomination of Dr. Condoleezza Rice to be America's Secretary of State. During the last 4 years, I've relied on her counsel.
There's only you in my life.
Benefited from her great experience,
the
strength, the grace.
I guess you could say it was love at first sight.
I'm very grateful to you,
my dear friend and mentor.
I am very much looking forward to joining the fraternity.
And now I'm honored she's agreed to serve in my cabinet.
It is humbling.
I can't tell you how much I love Connie Rice.
He is one of the finest public servants our nation has ever produced.
I can't tell you how lucky I am.
No one else will.
It was my honor to serve alongside him.
And when we come together.
Now, that's an image that I particularly like.
Connie's true ambition is beyond my power to grant.
We have one future that binds us.
Connie Rice is the right person for that challenge.
Yeah. Wow. How about this?
Isn't it a fact, Dr. Rice, that the August 6th PDB warned against possible attacks in this country? And I ask you whether you recall the title of that PDB.
I believe the title was Bin Laden Determined to Attack Inside the United States.
Oh, but that doesn't really mean anything. That was from the 9/11 Commission. Yes?
Well, yeah, and that doesn't count because she's up for Secretary of State now, so she won't be dealing with mundane matters like terrorism.
In October 2003, President Bush announced he was giving his National Security Advisor, Condoleezza Rice, the authority to manage post-war Iraq. Good job! With great fanfare, Rice was appointed head of the Iraq Stabilization Group. It didn't go so well. 7 months later, the group was essentially disbanded when they were like, uh-oh, can we just dissolve this quietly?
Because
this is never going to end.
It's not working.
It's never going to end. According to the White House website, the Iraq Stabilization Group hasn't been publicly mentioned for more than a year. That's good. So she's going to get confirmed, despite the fact that people are... I hope they ask her some good questions again and take her to task on Iraq and all the other BS and her ability to sort of, like, you know, crumble in the face of truth and just toe the party line.
Well, you know, the hearing starts today on Capitol Hill. No one, and I mean no one, not even Howard Dean, thinks that Condoleezza Rice is not going to be confirmed as Secretary of State. In fact, there are some predictions that say the full Senate may vote on Condoleezza Rice right after Bush is inaugurated on Thursday.
Just really quick.
Like, yeah, you know, just get it done. Get it done. Get it out of the way. The bottom line on Condoleezza Rice is she is going to now be the face of Bush's hardline policies in the world. She is going to be the person. Now, she talks about, and I don't know how you end up reconciling this sort of thing. She has some stuff on her plate. She wants to deal with AIDS in Africa. She wants to deal with all these different problems. But the big 800-pound gorilla on Condoleezza Rice's plate is and will be for the foreseeable future Iraq, because she was the shill for this administration and was one of the people who put forth the rationale for invading Iraq. The weapons of mass destruction, Saddam has got his finger on the nuclear trigger, all of that stuff.
Well, you know, as it turns out, continuing, I guess, what is going to be a habit, thank God, on behalf of Barbara Boxer, Senator Barbara Boxer.
Yes, she's got stones.
To be the only Democratic senator with any real
ovaries, I guess we're going to say, which are also part of the gonads.
Yeah.
So we can say femnads. Can we say that?
We can say heart. How about that?
Heart
femnads, is gender neutral.
If she is going to stand up and say Condoleezza Rice, quote, as you made your case, I personally believe that your loyalty to the mission you were given overwhelmed your respect for the truth in relation to what you were just talking about.
Yeah.
And, Barbara Boxer, thank you. Thank you for at least, you know, speaking, you know, some truth, having the guts to do it and making us feel like at least somebody is out there saying something that looks like confronting, the lies of this administration.
Yeah, and, you know, the rest of y'all who are probably going to get up, some of the Democrats are going to get up and say some unkind things about Condoleezza Rice. But the bottom line is nobody thinks she's not going to get confirmed. And at some point, when it comes to people like Alberto Gonzalez, when it comes to people like Condoleezza Rice, we have to say, how many of you have the ultimate nads to stand up and say, no, I'm not voting for this person?
Yeah.
That's the real question.
All right, here's Liberal Jenna. We're going to come back over the top of the hour there.
Yeah.
And talk about this. You know, the Center for American Progress has got a bunch of questions they'd like to hear us, and we'll go into some of that stuff. Here's the Liberal Agenda for today from the Streisand Compound. One, anytime someone asks you if you're going to watch the inauguration, say, I already saw a screening of it and it sucked. Two, name change. Fat Albert to plus size Albert. Three, join Dean's campaign to become DNC chairman. Throw your whole heart and soul into it, then wait to be bitterly disappointed. Four, as a distraction from the inauguration, start to care deeply about the Oscar nominations. And five, today's phrase, if someone asks you why you're wearing a dashiki and not at work, say, some people observe Martin Luther King weak, man. Wake up, sheeple. Wake up.
Yeah.
What do we got?
So we're going to talk more about Condoleezza Rice on the other side.
Yes.
We've got your dream diary with your deepest thoughts.
Liberal confessional.
The liberal confessional. Get your dialing fingers ready. We want to hear your shame as we roll on here on Air America Radio.
Maron, you're listening to Air America Radio at 6 past the hour, and this is Morning Sedition.
Good morning, geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, working class heroes, and people who enjoy French food. Yeah. See, now, you see what... How you doing, Mark Ryder?
I'm doing good,
what
man.
What Kalo's trying to do here, I see what he's doing. I see what you're doing, Chris.
He's getting even, is what he's doing.
We went to Daniel last night, Daniel Balud's place, with Alan Richman, our food critic, who we use on the show fairly frequently, the writer of Fork It Over. Nice guy.
More frequently after last night.
Right now, exactly. So Daniel, he's in cahoots with Daniel, they're buddies, and they set up this meal for us that we recorded, and we will play bits of next week sometime. But, man, this was something else. All right, but what we were saying on the break, let me just remind Chris what we had. This was a warm smoked lobster with an herb crust, sage royale, bacon lentil ragu, and a sauce cardinal.
Yes.
And then there were so many things. You know, within an hour, we'd had, like, you know, things from every ecosystem on the planet. There were oysters. There was foie gras.
I didn't eat any of that.
There was some clam. There was some caviar and sea urchin. There was all sorts of stuff.
Sea urchin. Goat cheese, which I don't normally eat.
Loup de mer baked in a salt crust. This was a whole fish that came out with a presentation. Three different kinds of wine. Philippe the Sommelier was there. So now it would probably cost you about $300 a pop, right? So now Chris on the Kalo on the break, after I talked about this, you're like, hey, who the hell would pay that kind of money for food? You know what I mean?
Well, I just don't think a meal is worth that kind of money.
How much money have you spent on drugs? How much money have you spent on clothes? How much money have you spent on anything that gives you immediate gratification? But it's the ritual and the
experience?
It's the experience, but it's like fireworks. You know, every time they bring out a plate, every plate's a different shape. You don't see what's going to happen. You got five guys, six guys bringing plates down. They bring out whole fish, they cut the fish, they got three or four different kinds of wine, they got five different kinds of bread that they bake downstairs, they make their own chocolates, there are these canapes that come out on these multi-tiered plates. Dude!
It's an experience.
It sounds fantastic, but you know what, you guys got it for free, And I'm just saying I would not pay that kind of money.
You got a pretzel? I got the bag of pretzels for you from the market.
Yeah, I got the
pretzel. But pretzel. You know what? I think that normally I think exactly the same way Kalo does.
I do, too.
That you know, look, there's nothing worth it.
I couldn't.
Money.
Right.
But you know what? I am going to go back. I promised my wife I would take her there for her birthday because the experience is just so beyond. And see, I'm not an ambiance person. I don't think, generally, as far as New York restaurants are concerned, I don't pay for ambiance. I'd rather go to a dumpy place with great food than to go to a place where they, you know, a whole palace.
I understand that, and that.
You know what I'm saying?
Well, of course,
but
well, why wouldn't
you? Different.
Why would you do that? No one can eat there every week. Not, you know, the last, I ate there one other time on a gift certificate, Caleb. On a gift certificate, I ate there. And you know who was sitting at the table two tables away from me?
Who's that?
Sumner Redstone. The Viacom, the guy who is the CEO of Viacom, sitting two tables away from me, all right?
Wow.
You know what I mean? And you know what's amazing? I said this last night, is that you see these guys. You know, I saw Sumner Redstone once that there, and I saw the guy, Rupert Murdoch, at the movies with his kid and his daughter-in-law. They're just schlumpy little guys. You know what I mean? These powerful owners of the world.
Titans of industry.
Yeah, I'm like, that's the guy in a windbreaker looking like that, 100 years old? You know, but not that it makes any difference. It's a small victory for me to say, I got something up on him, you know, when he could own the planet. But nonetheless, what I wanted to say is that I feel the same way you. If I spend more than a certain amount of money on a meal, I can't get it out of my head. I'm like, there's no way this is going to match up. But you can't think of it proportionally. You can't think about, you know, getting your money's worth has got to be a little more expansive when you're approaching this type of cuisine. Like you went to Vegas. Chris, how much did you drop in Vegas?
About $2,000.
How was that experience? Was that a good time?
That was a good time.
Yeah, really? What'd you get out of that?
Yeah, a lot of hurt feelings.
All right.
You know? It was a learning experience.
All right, well, see, now.
So would this be?
I'm saying that you could dump, if you brought your woman, your girlfriend, you brought her there and you spent like $250 on a special occasion, all right?
Yeah.
That you would bring away from that experience nothing but good feelings and having a great time.
Yeah.
Yeah, sure. But, you know, it's like Riley was saying that, like, the White House doesn't have great food. But, you know, I would say that I would rather go to the White House and have crappy food. And as opposed to going to this fancy restaurant in New York City.
Can I be honest with you?
Sure.
I bet you that the White House, that the guys at the White House, whatever his name is, you know.
Bush?
He would rather, this chef is world class, though. That's the thing. I mean, if you'd rather eat with George Bush as opposed to eat in New York.
Well, I'm not saying George Bush. I'm just saying, you know, like to be in the White House and have a meal and everything. That's something special.
Well, you can take a tour of the White House and bring in some KFC if you want. In a bag or something. You know what I mean?
Kalo fried chicken.
I don't know. Do they go through your snacks when you get to the White House?
Yeah, they do. They go through everything.
Well, take this though. Look at this. I was reading this thing. I read a little bit yesterday about the parade. All right, you remember
this
yesterday about what they're going to have to go through. Anyone who's marching in the parade, okay, thousands of performers, just marching bands, color guards, pom pom dancers, handbell ringers, real teams on horseback, Civil War reenactors will be bused early in the morning to the Pentagon parking lot across the Potomac in Virginia, while performers disembark and go through metal detectors. Bomb sniffing dogs will search the buses, then everybody will get back on the buses for a trip to the National Mall, where they will spend most of the day in heavily guarded warming tents. Participants have been warned that they will not be allowed to leave the tents except to go to the porta potty. All right. Other instructions given performers include a warning not to look directly at Bush while passing the presidential reviewing stand. Don't look in his eyes. All right. Not to look to either side and not to make any sudden movements. They're going to have snipers all over the place. This is going to be a potentially very uncomfortable situation for a lot of people. It's sort of like, hey, we're up here. We're up here.
Oh, whoa. Yeah. You know, that same audience. Article actually quotes a guy who I've met, a guy named Peter LaFlamme, who runs a drum and bugle corps in New Hampshire that's going to be at the parade. And, you know, he's still getting phone calls from the White House saying that they're making changes, last-minute changes in these procedures.
Sure. Oh, geez, I dropped my soda in the bleachers.
Whoa.
Oh, man.
Yeah. Well, hey, eyes right.
Oh, man, I need to. I got an itch on my knee. I just got a.
And this will all be an acceptable casualty rate for this $40 million.
Could you imagine if something bad like that happens?
Yeah, nothing will. I don't think. I mean, look,
isn't some part of you hope something bad will happen?
No, I think the terrorists are probably, you know, figuring this is the perfect time to let it go through because this guy is the best thing that ever happened to them.
I don't want terrorists. I want American badness.
Oh, American Badness. No, they're not going to let American Badness get within 10 miles of this.
I know. I was reading about the protesters, about all the different protesters that are going to be allowed to be there. But I assume they're going to be
in
far
Baltimore.
Away. Well, hopefully, you know, enough of them will get enough of them will get in without being detected. There's a big plan to do the big back turning.
No, you know what it is?
Route.
You got to show your role in order to be anywhere along the parade route.
What are you talking about?
Your bankroll.
Oh, really?
You have got to show that you have enough money so that people know that you contributed to the Bush campaign. That way, you get a spot on the inaugural route.
I just hope there's some sort of creative process. Maybe the soy bomb guy will figure out a new agenda. You know, you remember that guy? He went on the Grammys, Michael Portnoy. I'd like to see some stuff like that, some real culture, some sort of media jamming a moment where, you know, something very interesting, not necessarily violent, happens to throw off the momentum of the whole thing.
I don't think you know why I don't think it's going to happen? I think people are scared of getting shot. There's a lot of, you know, there's danger in trying to be counterculture these days.
That's right. Look at my hat.
I just thought of that hat that Liz Winstead has.
Oh, no, the big Uncle Sam hat.
Yeah, she wouldn't get away with wearing that to the inauguration.
Well, let's get back into Condoleezza Rice after this, and maybe I'll talk about the protests that are going to be allowed. And also, I'd like to say good morning to Cincinnati, Ohio.
Yeah!
We're on 1530 AM WCKY, the revolution of talk radio. We'll be back after this. It's 15 past the hour on Air America.
MorningSedition.com. Our guests, our comedy, your blog. MorningSedition.com. Courtesy of Air America Radio.
Nineteen past the hour. Good morning, Cincinnati, Ohio. 1530 AM WCKY, the revolution of talk radio. Hey, I'm going to be at Jimmy Tingle's Off-Broadway Theater in Davis Square, Somerville, Massachusetts, this Friday and Saturday. That's the 21st and 22nd, I believe, of January. Am I correct? Yes, I am. If you want to join the Morning Sedition Book Club to purchase our first book, Sam Lipsight's Homeland, you can go to MorningSedition.com. He'll be back in the studio January 28th to take your calls and discuss your book that has sentences like this.
Just turn to my intimate portraits page in the yearbook, and you'll see that I was never anything approaching buck-like. Not unless there's such a thing in nature as a buck turtle.
And the book is hilarious. Hilarious. Right now, I go to therapy one. Oh, not for 2 days. I'm going to hit a wall, dude. I'm going to hit a wall. Here's my dream diary from last night. I'm the auctioneer at a snooty auction house. I'm polished, refined. I smell like rosewood and clean towels. But the audience is filled with obese humanoids with lobster heads and octopus heads and cobra heads wearing business suits and snacking on live ferrets. Apparently, this is exactly who I expected to show up for this because very coolly I say, "Good afternoon. Today, the estate of the Bush administration is auctioning off certain items from its collection that it considers unnecessary during his second term." I say, "The first item up for bids is Social Security. This Bush administration has decided that this popular system for retired persons to live in dignity would be improved by selling it to people like you." The lobster heads and octopus heads and cobra heads shrieked with pleasure, made loud slurping noises, and threw ferret bones on the stage. "Do I hear an opening bid of 25 gajillion? 25, 25, 30, thank you, 30, 35, 40, 40, 45, yes sir, 50, 50 gajillion for Social Security, going once, going twice, sold to the warthog man with the sharp ivory tusks." I banged the gavel. "The next item up for bids is the environment. The Bush administration has decided that all existing air, water, soil, and trees are a threat to national security and should be sold off immediately. Do I hear 40 bazillion? 40, 40, 40, 45, 45, 50, and 60. Thank you, ma'am. Do I hear 70 bazillion for this lovely functional ecosystem? 75, 75, and sold to the eel lady." And finally, the Bush estate is offering this exquisite antique document once used to govern the United States of America known as the Constitution. Though its worth has steadily depreciated over the years from abuse and neglect, it could still be useful as a co-op for wall hanging. Plus, there may or may not be a map leading to a Masonic treasure on the back. The crowd went quiet. "Do I hear $20 for the Constitution? $20. Nothing. $15 for the Constitution. Do I have $10? Do I hear $10? No. Do I hear $5? Can I get $5 for the Constitution of the United States of America? No one wanted it. So I paid the $5 for it myself. I hung it up in my bathroom next to that picture of Elvis and Nixon shaking hands. I woke up and my bed was filled with cheese graters.
Ooh.
Yeah, what do you got there? Dude, quickly. Where are we at? Where are we at? Here we go. There's a couple other things you can't do at the parade. I just got a list in from our news source.
Uh-oh.
Because you can't look the parade people in the mind. They can't look in Bush's eyes. No quick movements. No one is allowed to be taller than the president, apparently. No one is allowed to be thinner than the president. He's very sensitive about that right now. And please, no eye rolling and no sighing at the president or... Uh-huh. No uncontrollable weeping at the president or maybe a little of this. Yeah, no officers in dress uniform with their snotty combat medals, no floats that have writing on them, none of that. No hybrid engines on the floats. Anyone seen with a hybrid engine?
Ooh.
Yeah. So it's going to be pretty tight security.
And they're also predicting snow showers for Thursday in Washington, D.C. Yeah, I mean, I fully, you know, I don't want anything bad to happen to anybody, but I want them all to be very cold, very wet, and, you know, just disgusted. By the end of this inauguration.
Are we being mean? Yes.
Yeah.
Is it okay? It is.
It is. This is America.
Sure it is. It is America. It's the land of the mean.
Yeah. Right. Ask Clint Eastwood.
Yeah. Here we go. These are some questions that some people would like to be asked of Condoleezza Rice during this nomination. I guess this is her confirmation hearing.
Yeah.
Question one. These come from the Center for American Progress. If you're not familiar with it, it's definitely worth looking at. You can get a link to it from our site. Question one. In a January 2002 memo to the president, Colin Powell said excluding detainees from the Geneva Conventions, as White House legal counsel Alberto Gonzalez had recommended, would undermine the protections of the law of war for our troops and have immediate adverse consequences for our conduct of foreign policy. The president rejected Powell's advice and adopted Gonzalez's recommendations. Who do you agree with? Colin Powell or Alberto Gonzalez?
Well, who does the president agree with?
Well, obviously Alberto Gonzalez.
Well, that's who Condi agrees with.
I guess you're right. But they should ask some of these questions because I wonder, do you think she would just answer it like that? Or would she do some sort of weird wraparound, kind of roundabout?
Oh, no, she'll do the weird wraparound roundabout, but then she'll end up saying, yeah, whatever he says.
How about this one, Riley? Question two. Only $2.2 billion of the $18 billion in funds allocated for the reconstruction of Iraq have been distributed. Explain why the funds are not being used and why Congress should feel compelled to sign off on another $100 billion supplemental.
Okay, I got the answer to
that. What would she say?
Okay, she would say, on the one hand, the funds are not being used because the president doesn't want them used, and the Congress should sign off on another $100 billion supplemental because that's what the president wants.
Man, that's it.
Hey, you towed a party line here. That's she's good at these things. Go ahead. You got another question?
I do. Let's try this one. How would you evaluate your performance as head of the Iraq Stabilization Group, Ms. Rice?
Did that ever exist, the Iraq Stabilization Group?
Remember?
I don't remember.
No, it was celebrated. You were going to look over the whole, you know, restabilizing and everything.
I don't remember.
How's that going now, Ms. Rice?
I don't remember.
You can't say you don't remember. You're a young person. What are you, retired?
I'm 50.
Huh?
I'm 50. I don't have to remember everything,
right.
Okay?
Is she 50?
Yeah.
Oh. Recently, the Pentagon has been considering organizing assassination and kidnapping squads of Iraqis to fight the insurgents. Do you oppose this tactic known as the Salvador option?
The president is against violence in all forms, but if we have to, we'll use it.
Wow.
So, no, I don't oppose it. If he thinks it's necessary.
Wow.
How's that?
So that's just going to be the way it's going to go.
Okay?
Yeah, it sounds like you're doing great. It's frightening how well you did. I guess it's not that hard to get into the mind of somebody who's just going to toe the party line.
Hey!
Right?
Come on. Bring it.
Whatever the president wants, we'll do. Unbelievable. So, you know, we got the liberal confessional coming up.
Oh,
How about this one? The White House has blocked over $88 million from the Global Fund, a group known internationally as the best weapon in the battle against AIDS. Will you follow through on support to the fund?
Not if the president blocked it.
No. She would never say that.
No.
She will say, of course we will.
No. What she'll say is the president has a deep commitment to fighting the AIDS epidemic across the world. He just didn't think this $88 million was going to be used properly.
866-303-2270. The liberal confessional is coming up. We'd like you to confess your sins.
Confess your sins.
866-303-2270.
Show us your shame.
Yes, please.
We'll show you ours.
You know how it feels.
When we come back here on Air America Radio.
Thank you.
Marin and Mark Riley. Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Past the hour, Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Hey.
It's Morning Sedition. It's Air America Radio coming to you on 1530 AM WCKY in Cincinnati. Good morning to our new affiliate in Cincinnati,
The
Revolution of Talk Radio. As again, if you want to join the Morning Sedition Book Club, purchase Sam website's Homeland by going to morningsedition.com and enjoy things like this.
We didn't have squash at Eastern Valley. We didn't have tennis either, unless you count that trick with the steel hairbrush and the catgut racket, whereby the butt skin of the weak was flayed.
Yes, more of that. Sam Whipside's Homeland. I will be performing at Jimmy Tingle's Off-Broadway Theater in Davis Square, Somerville, this weekend, Friday and Saturday, the 21st and 22nd.
There it is.
And you know, Riley, sometimes it's not easy being a liberal. We all stray from the straight and narrow from time to time, but when we need to unburden ourselves, we can always confess our liberal sins. If you want to take a turn in the liberal confessional, give us a call at 866-303-2270. That's 866-303-2270. But right now, it's my turn. Bless me, Brother Riley. For I have sinned.
How can I ease your burden, my son?
Well, it's about Inauguration Day, Riley. I'm not going to protest. I might even spend one thin dime. In fact, I'll probably spend several thin dimes. I think that boycotting the retail economy as a way to protest Bush is a great idea, but I'm sorry. All right? I know around 2 that afternoon, I'm going to need a Starbucks espresso, and that's all there is to it, Mark.
I see. So this will be the day that you inaugurate your apathy about Bush's second term?
No. No. Look, I want to do something, but the inauguration is outdoors, and if you've been outside lately, it's frickin' cold, man.
So what you're saying is political action is not an option if it involves an overcoat?
No, I'm just saying I don't know if all this symbolism does anything. Maybe the best we can hope for is that maybe a William Henry Harrison thing might happen again. You never know.
Ooh.
Yeah.
A William Henry Harrison reference. My son, you are obviously straying from the path of righteousness. Therefore, as your penance, I want you to take a Morning Sedition oath of office. Now, put your hand on the good book.
The Bible?
Well, it's a Bible to some of us. Put your hand, your left hand, of course, on this copy of Hegemony or Survival, America's Quest for Global Dominance by Noam Chomsky. Now, repeat after me. I, Mark Maron. Do solemnly swear.
Do solemnly swear.
To faithfully execute the office of comedian and radio talk show host.
Speaking of which, if we keep repeating everything you say, it's going to make for one repetitive and overlong radio segment, my friend.
Point well taken. Instead, your penance is to commit to committing not fleeting symbolic protest, but meaningful, substantive opposition. Because the actual inaugural is not nearly as important as our actions in the coming days and weeks and months during what this inauguration represents, the second Bush administration.
Wow, okay, so in other words, the next few years will do more to test our resolve than any meaningless ceremonial event featuring a Brooks and Dunn concert, right? Is that what you're saying?
Amen to that. Now go forth and sin. No more.
Thanks. All right. You know, Brother Riley, I thank you for your absolution. And now, if anyone else out there wants to confess and seek liberal grace in our liberal confessional, you can give us a call right now at 866-303-2270. That's 866-303-2270. Steve, listening to the mic in Madison, Wisconsin, what is your sin?
Hello, fellas. How are you doing this
week? I'm okay.
We're doing all right.
Well, you know, my thing is, I'm angry, and we liberals, you know, or I guess we're now progressives, as my girlfriend says, we're not supposed to be angry, right? We're better than that lizard brain reactivity, you know. You know, we love the granola, we love the animals. Mr. Maron,
yes.
You know, I know you're a Tom Petty fan. I'm angry at Tom Petty for not showing up at the tsunami thing, you know.
Uh-huh.
Where was he during the election? Where was this man?
Where was Tom Petty?
You know, but yeah. he was in a hollow tree somewhere. I don't know where he was, you know.
That's what you're worked up about?
Well, I'm a little worked up about that. That's a lead into to the Bush. Of course I'm mad at him, you know, that no accountability because he's reelected.
Yeah.
You know, where's that logic follow when Ken Starr was digging through Bill Clinton's underwear drawer, you
absolutely.
Know?
Absolutely.
You know, I guess well, they should have closed down that whole investigation then. Oh, well, he's reelected.
Yeah.
He's reelected. We don't have to do this anymore, you know?
Right.
You know, I would love to be able to come up to Bush during the inauguration, look him straight in the eye, move all twitchy and all jumpy, and confuse him and by saying, you know where the weapons of mass destruction went. You know, Magneto and the Brotherhood of Evil Mutants did it. Dude, Klingons are responsible.
Right.
The Cylons got them, my friend.
You can't twitch and jump in front of the president because they'll...
Yep.
But let me tell you something.
What?
I'm one twitchy, jumpy little guy, too.
Well, here's what you know, basically you're asking for what? You're asking for absolution because you're angry? You should be angry. We should all be angry. And what I say you should do is during the inauguration, if you could stomach it, it's spit on the TV day.
That's spit on the TV day?
Yes. When you see George Bush, feel free to spit right in his face on the TV.
I'm soaking my Samuel.
Thanks for calling. I
hope
I helped you out.
You bet, man.
Yeah. The Tom Petty thing, I got to cut him loose on that one.
He's angry with Tom Petty. I mean, what are you going to do?
But what about
Sammy Hagar?
But he said it like there was a press release or something. Tom Petty will not be, you know. Was there? Maybe I missed it.
Good unforeseen for his circumstances.
I do love the Tom Petty. I guess he just wanted one of his heroes to get up and do something. Joan, listening to LIB in Long Island.
Hi, Joan.
What is your confession?
Listen, you're great. I love you. My confessional is, I'm so angry at Bush and everything that's gone on with this administration. I'd love him to fall on his ass during the inauguration, embarrass himself.
You want him to fall on his ass and embarrass himself during the inauguration?
Correct.
I don't think there's anything wrong with that at all. I assume you're feeling a little bit guilty because you're wishing someone else hurt themselves. But given the amount of pain this man has caused throughout the world and the amount of negligences and the amount of hardship that his policies cause people around the world every day, I don't think you have to apologize for anything.
Thank you.
Yeah, and I'm going to let you off the hook. And also, feel free, as I said, Joan, to the other guy, during the inauguration on TV, you're free to spit on the screen. Or actually, you can actually press your buttocks onto the screen against Bush, and that way maybe that'll make him fall.
Yeah, or, you know, get a banana peel or something.
That wasn't meant as a sexual thing. It didn't imply a nude buttocks or anything else, but just to literally say, hey, there he is. I'm going to squish my butt onto the screen and then just go, ha, ha, ha.
Yeah, and it could be men and women.
And then, yeah, and someone walks in like, what are you doing? I'm putting my butt in Bush's head. Ah, ha.
Yeah. Bush is right. Kissing. Oh, never mind.
All right. Maybe that's a little immature, but sometimes the symbolic gestures of rebellion can be that simple in order to make yourself feel better, and it may necessarily not have the effect.
Are you going to watch this thing, man? Are you going to watch the inauguration?
No. I don't plan to watch it. You know, but maybe if I'm flipping around, you know, and it comes on, and I feel like going up there and putting my butt on the screen, I might do that. That's fun. And if enough people do it, who knows what could happen? You know, if enough butts come together, pressed against screens across this country during the inauguration, this could facilitate change, people. This is not a waste of time. And it's fun, too. Maybe you could have a Bush butt party, you know, and have bowls of chips and everything and go, whose turn is it now? It's the middle of the speech. Ooh, I'm going to press my butt on the screen during the prayer. That's fun. And then, all right, anyways. I'm getting a little carried away.
Sounds a little Randy Moss-like.
I don't know what the hell I'm talking about. Matt in St. Paul, what do you have to confess?
Mark, hey, I Googled up my friends, the people I think were my friends on one of those web database websites where you find out who contributed to Bush, you know, and you put in your zip code and it gives you a list.
Oh, God, yeah.
And, boy, I tell you, it wasn't too ugly except in a couple cases. So here I am at a groundbreaking a month ago, and there's one of them at the end of the line, and I'm thinking, do I look at him? Do I talk to him? Do I shake his hand? What do I do?
Oh.
And I gave in, and I went over, and I said hello, and I shook his hand, and I have been trying to wash my hand for a whole month, and nothing will come off, I tell
you. Matt, I got a penance for you. The next time you see somebody like that that you know contributed, walk up, kiss him full in the mouth and whisper in his ear, I know it was you, Fredo. I knew it was you all along.
Oh, that's good. Ooh, I like that. That's good. Ooh.
Thanks for calling, Matt. Take care.
Thanks, man.
You broke my heart, Fredo.
You broke my heart,
Fredo. You broke my heart. Brian, or listening to LIB in Brooklyn, what's your confession, Brian?
I, once upon a time, about a year ago, I purchased Nike rollerblades.
Oh, that's horrible.
Wow.
Yeah.
So I hope you had fun at the expense of the 3-year-old that made your rollerblades.
Yeah.
Did you have fun?
Actually, they fell apart on me.
Really?
Why did
that's because the kid wasn't getting
the wheel
paid.
The wheels started coming off from the front of the wheels. I actually hurt myself because of them.
Oh, you've already paid your penance then. So why don't you get
Did you hire a lawyer? Did you make any money off of this?
No, I didn't.
Well. Yeah, well, that serves you right. See, you know, that is the karma of little 7-year-old hands that couldn't quite put the wheels on your rollerblades properly in Indonesia or whatever, wherever they made those. So it sounds like you already paid your penance. And maybe, you know, next time you see a kid trying to rollerblade, maybe give him a hand.
Yeah.
Of course, I always do.
Oh, thank you, Brian. Well, thank you for calling. It's very, very great to talk to you. We'll take some more calls with more confessions at 866-303-2270 after the break. This has been a very...
This has been a really cathartic. Is that the right word?
It's been moving.
Yeah.
I'm going to work on the sort of pressing your butt against the TV screen during the inaugural campaign. That's a little crass. A little immature.
Hey!
Might feel good. Maybe I won't push it. But,
television
you know,
is television.
Call us, 866-303-2270, 44 past the hour, morning sedition.
Who are these people? Morning Sedition.
It's on record, it's out. It's no secret anymore.
Morning Sedition from Air America Radio.
Night past the hour, Mark Maron here with Mark Riley on Morning Sedition, still taking a couple of confessions. 866-303-2270 if you have some liberal sins.
And we know you do.
Like to share with us, we're willing to try and give you some absolution if possible. Jim listening to LIB in Manhattan. Jim.
Hey guys, how you doing?
Good, how are you?
Excellent. Mark, this is an interesting story. I work for wealthy people, celebrities. Often that are like redoing their apartments.
Uh-huh.
We're here in Manhattan, in the Hamptons, in Fairfield County, wherever money is, I'm there.
Uh-huh.
Oh, here's the thing. Can I like name a famous actor that I work for?
Absolutely.
Sure.
Okay. Everybody thinks that Mr. Harrison Ford is such a nice guy.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, right?
Uh-huh.
This guy is a class A number one, you know what.
Oh, good.
And he has, like, I have seen him personally, and he has, like, run me through the ringer over, like, things being off by, like, a 16th of an inch, and he plays on the fact that he used to be, like, a contractor, like he's some kind of everyman.
Uh-huh.
The dude is totally not. Well, here's the confession.
Yeah.
Confession is, I don't stand up. I usually play, like, lapdog to, like, celebrities and rich people. Oh, yeah, sure, man, no problem.
Uh-huh.
Oh, yeah, I'll take care of it.
Uh-huh.
Dude, there are people, like, starving all over the world. I'm not going to sit here and fuss with this crap for you. Oh, no, it's insane. You make $20 million a film. What are you worried about? That kind of stuff.
Yeah.
It drives me insane.
Yeah.
So that's where I'm at. Help.
Okay. Here's what I suggest you do. I'm assuming you do some sort of design or contracting work.
Exactly.
Okay. It's time to start sabotaging rich people's houses. Okay? You know, I don't know, you know, maybe sort of, you know, faucets that go whoosh and squirt them in the face.
Yeah.
You know, maybe toilets that break. That's always funny. You know.
You're a 16th of an inch off? Next time be a half inch, an inch off.
Yeah, garbage disposals that spit the food back out. Here's what you do. Do something a little off center, and then when they say, is this off center? You go, no, there's something wrong with you. I think you have some sort of vertigo. Maybe you should go to the doctor. It's time. Yeah.
If I could pull that off with a straight face, it would be fantastic.
I think it's the only way. It's sort of subtle sabotage that you can blame on them.
Oh, you know what else you can do, Jim, now that I think of it? You know, celebrities are, you know, they like to keep up with the Joneses. So the next time you get somebody that's, you know, being a real idiot, just tell them about somebody else's house and how much nicer it is than theirs.
And then they'll go, what do they have that I don't have? And then just make something really crappy up.
Crappy up, yeah.
All right, Jim, thanks for calling.
Thanks. Thanks.
Uh-oh.
How great is that?
Uh-oh.
Harrison Ford. Oh, who would have known? Yeah, okay, here's an email. This is a confessional email. I was in a bar with my girlfriend, a new crowded barbecue restaurant in Harlem. We were crowded up against a guy with his girlfriend sitting on his lap, whom he was aggressively pawing. We started talking, and I learned that he voted for Bush, and he started telling me what a great country this is and how we need a leader like this, et cetera, et cetera. I also found out that he was married. His girlfriend was married, and not to each other. I confess I did not tell the guy what I thought about his choices, both personally and politically. While he spewed his jingoistic hatred at me, I just sat silent and nodded, not wanting to cause a scene. I went to the bathroom at the same time his girlfriend left. He hit on my girlfriend. His girlfriend went over to the fairway and threw up. When we left, he invited us up to have another drink next week. We said we'd consider it. If I can't tell an MF-er like this off in Manhattan, do I have a spine I can rent?
Oh, I got a solution.
There's
for
some
him.
Confusion. There's a lot of messages going on here. It sounds like you want to tell him off, but there's an outside chance that you might have swinger group sex with him.
Well, that's what I was thinking. You know, to talk, tell his girlfriend and the guy's married girlfriend to have a threesome.
Yeah. So I say what you do is maybe get on that Riley train and try to have sex with his girlfriend, and then tell him what you think and leave. Hey,
yeah.
Is that wrong? Is that wrong? But make sure it's okay with your girlfriend. Maybe these are the morals you're talking about that you didn't approve of him. You know, I just shut him down and call him a creep. And maybe
what is a Bush supporter doing at a new barbecue restaurant in Harlem anyway?
They're everywhere. They're like virus. You know, show up places that you know
trying to be trendy. Huh?
All right, let's take another.
Look,
question.
I love the Negroes as much as the next guy.
Do we absolve him in any way? Do we help that guy? Maybe if you could just get into a situation where they all get drunk and you can get them, you know, take some pictures, blackmail. Always good.
Yeah.
Yeah, but that's not the
woman was married, right?
Yeah, they were both married.
Oh, yeah, well, tell her husband.
And one of them was throwing up outside the woman. You know, it sounds...
Tell her husband about the throwing up.
Hot.
No, easy.
What we say doesn't... We don't represent the progressive movement. We represent Morning Sedition's opinion. So don't judge.
Yeah. Don't email the network about us, okay?
John in New Jersey, what can we do? What's your confession?
Well, I went to Danielle once and ate probably a meal something like yours.
Wow.
And I felt pretty bad about it.
Yes.
But, you know, one of the things that you might consider...
Yeah.
Now, you may have to confess, that fellow you ate dinner with, this guy Richmond, I know him in the business. In the business, he's known as, if it's free, it can't be bad. And you may want to...
So what's wrong with that?
You may want to check out who you eat dinner with. That's my confession.
Oh, wow. That's your confession?
John.
That Alan Richmond is a bad guy? Wait a minute.
No, he didn't say he was a bad guy. He said that, he likes a free meal. And that
who
he's
doesn't?
Known, right, he's known in the business as a guy who likes a free meal. And, Alan Richmond, definitely a friend of ours. And, you know, whatever this guy says, this guy sounds like he's got some sour grapes, right? He says he feels guilty about eating at Daniel. And then he takes a crap on our buddy, Alan Richmond, who got us the food at Daniel. I think that John in New Jersey is a little upset that maybe Alan Richmond didn't take him to dinner. Now, I understand.
He had to pay.
Now, he's some sort of, he's a guy, he's like in the dark going, I'll show that food critic. That food critic. He just likes to eat for free. Exactly. And where's the mystery? I don't know what.
Maybe he's a chef, man. Maybe he's a chef at a restaurant that Alan didn't like that much.
That's possible. There's a lot of possibilities. He lives in New Jersey. Maybe he knows Alan personally. But basically, his sin is slander, my friends.
Yes.
And how
does he make good on this slander?
But you know what? The thing is that we also took some slander from Harrison about Harrison Ford, but we got a tremendous joy in that because it revealed something in Harrison Ford that a lot of people don't know about. It was candor. But this is just a guy taking a shot at a guy's profession.
And he's our guy.
Who the hell doesn't know that food critics want free food?
Want free food.
But I'll tell you what, you know, as long as we got involved in the free food, that was great. And this guy, you know, I'm sorry that you're upset about whatever you're upset about, but I don't even know.
You know what it was? He was, I think he was trying to also backhand us, saying we probably took a freebie too, so maybe we're just like Alan Richmond because we like freebies.
Who the hell doesn't like freebies?
I don't know.
What is this guy talking about?
It's part
about?
Of the American dream, pal. Maybe wake
guy,
up.
I think this guy should give a little money, as we all should, to the tsunami victims. And if you want to, go to morningsedition.com.
Never been to a one-day sale, pal?
Oh, sorry. That
goes under the heading of creepy calls. Because, it starts out legit, and all of a sudden it's like, man, I don't like that guy.
I don't like that Alan.
He doesn't clean his part of the sidewalk over here. All right, so where are we at now? We're going to talk to Cousin Alice, George Bush's 15th cousin, who is busy on a sort of rabid letter-writing campaign to her distant cousin, and we've gotten her to read some of those letters.
Yeah, she's preparing for the inauguration.
I will be at Jimmy Tingle's Off-Broadway Theater in Davis Square, Somerville, Massachusetts, this Friday and Saturday. You can go to the tour dates page on morningsedition.com for info and tickets. You can do a lot of things there. You can join the book club and buy Sam Witsite's book. I also want to say good
Morning, Cincinnati, Ohio. We're on 1530 AM WCKY, the revolution of talk radio there.
Absolutely. We're also going to talk a little bit about consumerism and the American Revolution when we come back here on Air America Radio.
Mark Maron at 6 past the hour here on Air America Radio, and this is Morning Sedition.
Good morning, geniuses, philosopher, kings and queens, working class heroes. Tom Petty, where are you? Where is Tom Petty when you need him? We got a call last hour of a guy just sort of like, and what, you know, during this tsunami thing, where was Tom Petty? Where was Tom Petty during the elections if it was only for Tom Petty, if he had just stood up? Our guy, and I think he called from Madison, Wisconsin, just wants to know where Tom Petty is and how come he didn't step forward and take responsibility for this world. Mark Riley, Tom Petty. It's
Tom
all
Petty.
On Petty's hands.
Is
all,
it?
No.
Tom Petty?
No.
Not Smokey Robinson?
No. Well, I don't know. Where's Smokey Robinson?
Okay.
Where is he?
James Brown?
Why isn't James Brown helping us? This is a hard time in the world.
50 Cent?
50 Cent, help us. 50 Cent, give us a dollar.
Jay-Z? Oh, no, he's at Daniels.
That's what we heard. That was kind of funny.
It was. You know, they see me, the brother, at the table.
Immediately, Daniel goes, well,
Jay-Z, Puffy comes in here. Should see all the blacks we get.
Yeah. So, good morning, Cincinnati, Ohio. We're on 1530 AM WCKY, the revolution of talk radio. You can join the Morning Sedition Book Club and purchase Sam Woodside's Homeland by going to morningsedition.com. And he'll be back in the studio on January 28th to discuss his book. Here's a little taste.
Feeling is not quite the word for the feeling. How's bathing at knife point in the phlegm of the dead? Is that a feeling?
Hilarious. You got to get that book. The laughs never stop. It's dark. It's deep. It's heavy stuff. And it addresses all of the things that many progressives and liberals carry deep inside them. The sad, self-centered fear of failure. The horrendous pangs of bitterness in a life not panning out the way it was.
And the flip.
Supposed to be. The flip. That there's a description. The dude's a master wordsmith. And those were just some of the more graphic moments of poetry within the book. Listen to me. Toot my buddy's horn. Texas journalist Jim Moore is going to be with us tomorrow. We always enjoy to talk to him.
Oh, yeah, he's good.
T.H. Breen, later in this hour, author of The Marketplace of the author of The Marketplace of Revolution. He talks about how the seeds of revolution, the American Revolution, are sown on the local level, and in that case, boycotts, you know, which a lot of people use today. You know, if you go to choosetheblue.com, you can find out, you know, which companies you want to do business with. I remember there was an oversight on my part, not even an oversight. I put it out there, you know, about Costco because I know Chris enjoys shopping at Costco.
Exactly.
Yeah, apparently he's got two crates of cup of noodles.
Oh, he's got 5 million chicken cutlets.
Yeah, he said he came in and was like, dude, the butt chicken cutlets.
I backed a van up at Costco and brought some chicken cutlets.
Now, well, that's like one of the liabilities of those kind of stores. It's like, yeah, I just wanted to get some chips. I got tires. I got tires in my car and new washing machines on the way.
That's how they get you, though.
Yeah.
It is.
Yeah.
I mean, they plan, they lay their stores out that way. They know that a lot of people come in to buy one or two items, and they want you to impulse buy whatever else.
But Costco's one of the good guys, so feel free to shop at Costco. No, it's almost all the money goes to the Democrats.
Did you hear that Walmart has begun this huge PR campaign? They're running ads and print ads, TV ads, trying to make themselves look like great corporate citizens.
Really?
Yeah.
And how are they doing that?
Well, by portraying their workers as being happy, content, non-unionized people.
Oh, boy, they've really got a spell on those people.
Oh,
huh?
Yeah. Well, 5 years ago, I was on death row. Now I'm working at Walmart making $10 an hour. See, I'm having a wonderful life.
Yeah.
Thank you.
What else is a 90-year-old man going to do? Thank God for Walmart. He's giving me the job as a greeter.
Now that I'm out on parole, it's really great to be able to come back into the workforce.
Come in.
I'm sorry. I shouldn't say this.
So come on down to Walmart and buy some stuff.
Yeah. Oh, you're going straight to hell.
Am I? Again?
Yeah, why not?
Oh, my God.
We've all been there.
How many times does that have to happen?
Hey.
So, look at that. Let's hear from Cousin Alice. This is a great thing. This woman called us last week,
and, you know, out of nowhere, actually. And she said she's George Bush's 15th cousin. Right. And she is in a busy, very busy. Right. She's a listener of our show. All right. She called in, as I said, and she's been writing letters to her cousin. She's from Canton, Massachusetts. And again, George Bush's 15th cousin, Alice Graham.
Dear Cousin George, about that puff interview you gave on Disney ABC, what a cartoon it was. Hard enough to bear your whining voice and good old boy lies, but combining that with Baba Wawa's simpering pettiness was more than I could handle. I'm sure you explained how you were going to bring us out of the $3 trillion debt you've put us in. As a statesman, you will surely correct that mistake by rescinding the tax break you gave your buddies. That's a lot easier than rescinding the 101,400 deaths of Iraqis and Americans who died for nothing but your greed and control of the Mideast. Power has made you and your junk mail maggot mentor, Karl Rove, quite mad, you know. I can only pray that you remain a figurehead and don't cast off those who made you. Without their guidance, your cowboy antics would create the nuclear holocaust a lot faster than if we just await the inevitable. Your 16th cousin, Hale Brown, my middle son, has a master's degree in numerical analysis from Georgia Tech. Unlike you, he was an A student. He tells me that the odds that a suicide bomber will put together the two parts of an atom bomb that will provide his critical mass are getting exponentially better daily as you destroy more and more innocent lives but leave survivors intent upon revenge. But you, Cousin Laura, and your mediocre daughters are doing just fine. You've got to go get ready for the people's celebration of your theft of the presidency, at least people with incomes of over a million. The rest of us will be harassed and jailed by the police, as usual, as they did in the year 2000. Got to go. Cousin Alice.
She's great.
She is great.
I apologize. I don't know what the hell I was looking at. Her name is Alice Copeland Brown. She's from Canton, Massachusetts. She is George W. Bush's 15th cousin. You know, sometimes I get so much papers here that I just look at one thing and it's like I'm collecting names in my head. But
we're making her America's cousin. I want you to know that. She's no longer just George W. Bush's 15th cousin.
Yeah.
She's America's cousin.
Yeah. Hopefully we're going to get some more stuff. I'm sure she's going to call back and we're going to record some more of these letters. I think they're endearing and cutting, and they're crass and they're good.
Mediocre daughters, boy, that was tough.
Yeah, she takes some shots, man.
Yeah.
So let's when we come back, let's hit some of this stuff about the interest. Who is funding this inauguration? What do they want? And how evil are they? We'll be back and talk about the corporate influence in the inaugural party scene. It's 13 past the hour, Air America Radio.
Morning Sedition, on the air and online at morningsedition.com from Air America Radio.
Past the hour, Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Good morning.
I'm still recovering from Daniel last night, man.
Me too.
Unbelievable. Hey, so Ramon came by wearing a priest outfit earlier. As the inauguration approaches, one of the most important people is someone you've probably never heard of. Some of you have, I'm sure. Michael Gerson is Bush's speechwriter. He's a born-again evangelical who just can't help inserting religious language into W's speeches, even though he had a mild heart attack last December. God must like him because he's back on his feet and hard at work. Here's Gerson's Palm Pilot for today. 5 a.m., wake up, pray. Ask God for the patience to endure Bush when he says things like, hopefuler, or uninalienable rights, or is our children learning? Is they? 7 a.m., revise speech. Make sure right-wingers know that the phrase ownership society does not mean we're bringing back slavery. 7:30 a.m., comb Deuteronomy for any references to Social Security. 8:30 a.m. Work gospel lyrics into speech. I got shoes. You got shoes. All God's children got shoes. 10 a.m. Work with Mr. Bush on revisions to coded language. Jacob's ladder means flat tax. Water into wine means faith-based funds. Lot's wife means gay marriage ban. Parting the Red Sea means tort reform.
2 p.m. Review address to make sure it contains no concrete plans. And 5 p.m., call Jesus. Ask for punch-up. There you go. Man, this inauguration thing is going to get a little crazy. Just in security. Just security alone, my friend.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, just what they're requiring of the marching band. People performing in the parade who are going to be walking by the grandstand. I mean, it says participants have been warned that they will not be allowed to leave the tents, these warm tents, except to go to a porta potty. All right. And other instructions are they were given performers they include a warning not to look directly at Bush while passing the presidential reviewing stand, not to look to either side, and not to make any sudden movements. It's like, you know, just a. Could you imagine that? The tuba player is like, oh, I got an itch on my butt. Here's some other things that they're not supposed to do. We should have had a clanking horn there. I wish we were. That was a weird laugh I just did. You hear that? What is that? Everybody's going to put their butt on the screen. All right, here we go. Not where am I? All right, here's some other rules. No one is allowed to be taller than the president, or else, you know. No one is allowed to be thinner than the president. He's very sensitive about that right now. Hey, who's the rail up in the front row? No eye rolling or sighing at the president. No uncontrollable weeping. That's funny. No officers in dress uniform with their snotty combat medals, and no floats that have writing on them. No hybrid engines on the float. That would be bad. And now these float manufacturers have been working overtime, round the clock, to make the fun. Did you know that, Riley?
Yeah, I heard about that. Yeah. Well, you know, because...
Couldn't find a bison.
Yeah.
Yeah, Cheney wanted a Wyoming float.
Yeah.
Wanted a bison on there. Couldn't find one. Combed the country.
What do they want? He want the actual state on a float so people would know where it was?
They wanted a stuffed buffalo. And apparently they had a lot of trouble finding a stuffed buffalo. I don't even know if they got one. Here's some other weird floats that they're doing. They've got a float to represent all the blue states. They'll have a vineyard of sour grapes. They've got here's the Ohio float, which is very touching. It's a locked voting booth with hundreds of black voters lined up outside.
Yeah, yeah, I can see that one.
The Nevada float, this one features a roulette wheel, but someone will have to remember to keep the president from jumping up on the float and betting the entire Social Security trust fund on red.
Uh-huh.
All right. How about this? What else we got? I don't know. Bye-bye. Okay, let's talk about the sponsors of the inauguration. Financing the inauguration, 53 companies gave the maximum $250,000 donation toward President Bush's inauguration this week. Of course, they're standard ones that you'd think. You know, you've got AT&T, Washington, D.C., Bank of America Corporation, Bristol-Myers. You've got Chevron, Texaco. You've got FedEx, Exxon. Man, look at all these. Altria, of course, cigarettes for the kids. You got Ford Motor Company.
Whoa. Cigarettes for the kids?
That's what Philip Morris used to be, Altria.
Oh, okay.
And, you know, I started smoking when I was a kid. Why? I don't know. Advertising.
Oh, I did. I was 15.
You started smoking when you were a kid, didn't you? 15.
Yeah. Yeah,
wow.
15.
I started at 14, actually.
Really?
Yeah.
I went from 1965 through 1990, 25 years.
I smoked for 20 years, and I regret it. It's one of the only regrets I have in my life, my friend. I really, cigarettes are about the stupidest thing you can do to yourself. Really, the stupidest thing you can do to
yourself. Well, you know what cigarettes bother? What bothers me about cigarettes is that you create this void for yourself when you don't have them. And it gives you the impression that you really can't do without them, that they're part... You know, they're part and parcel of the way you live your life. They're like, hey, man, you know, I know there's a risk, but hey, they make me feel good. You know, I feel great after I have a meal and I smoke. You know, there are a zillion different rationales for not stopping.
But after a certain point, you don't feel anything. You don't feel anything.
I know, but you can't convince yourself of that. For the public consumption, you got to say you feel something. Otherwise, you feel like a complete ass for doing it.
You're just getting straight all the time. That's all you're doing. You're just getting normal, so you're not itchy and uncomfortable. And I got to be honest with you. I loved sucking hot smoke into my face. I loved the feeling of burning smoke going into my lungs. I loved smoke coming out of my mouth. I loved smoking. I loved it. I would get up in the morning, I'd drink a double espresso, smoke 5 cigarettes, and have to take a nap. I would blow my entire energy wad right when I got up in the morning. Just like I would get jammed on cigarettes and coffee, like, and then have to take a nap.
Yeah.
But you know what? Honestly, it was such a brain...
It was just, what cigarettes do to your brain, like you're saying, the addiction, it's deep, it's in, and
it is.
There's this myth around them.
It's insidious, that's the thing.
There's a myth around them, you think they're cool, you think they're good, and like now, like, you know, I see people smoking outside, I've been off smokes, I've been off cigarettes for 4 years almost, or maybe five, I gotta figure that out. 4 years, and, which, oh my God, it was just, it was 4 years last month.
Okay.
So, but the thing is like I see people smoking now cigarettes, and I'm like, look at that idiot blowing smoke out of his head. You know, all I can see is just a head with smoke coming out. And I'm like, how can that be good for anybody?
And let me tell you something.
What?
This is the true test. Now we're in the Eastern time zone here. We're in New York City.
Yeah.
It is about a degree and a half outside. Okay,
yeah.
And you're still going to see people coming out of their offices with no coats on, going around to a little cubby hole somewhere smoking a cigarette.
The weird thing is, Riley, it's like booze or anything else. If you've got a problem with anything, you know, at some point you got to say, you know what, there's really no end to this. All right, I'm going to keep sucking these things down, you know, 20 a day, you know,
yeah.
Two packs a day, whatever you've decided to allot yourself. And at some point, this is the big fallacy, is that they're going to kill you. I mean, they're going to kill you somehow. Now, either you can be one of those people that's sort of like, hey, everybody's going to die, and hey, people get hit by a car, and then there's always the one rationalization, hey, my grandfather lived to 100 and he smoked two packs a day. It's like, well, he was genetically lucky, and who the hell knows if he was a
stranger. If he wasn't smoking, he could have lived to 150.
Right, well, that's the case, but after a certain point, though, you cannot deny that they're hurting you, you know, because, like, you'll sit there and you're like, no, I still love them, they taste great, and you're like, and people are like, what is that? That's my lung, it whistles sometimes. I don't know what it is. You know, you know, it's just like, what is that? And you're just sitting there rationalizing this horrendous pain in your chest.
You hear, you know, that whole thing about barfing up a lung. That was kind of what got me started thinking about stopping.
But that's the genius of cigarettes and how insidious they are. Is you wake up going, and you're like, you know what? I need a cigarette to burn through this mucus that's lining, this cancerous black phlegm that's lining the tubes of my lungs. The only thing that's going to help me this morning is if I suck down some hot smoke and melt the cancer for today. That's what they do to you. What am I getting all worked up about?
I don't know, man. You know, you could do some American Cancer Society spots or something. You know what I mean?
You know who does those? People who are dying of cancer.
Yeah, I know.
I don't want those tapes. If you're seeing this, that means I've died already. That was my agreement. The Yul Brynner tapes, those are horrendous.
Yes. There was a guy here that used to be the head of the police union that did a similar set of spots. It was one of the things that made me stop.
We didn't talk about what we were supposed to talk about. We're going to talk to T.H. Breen about the way they protested through boycott during the American Revolution and how we can use that power now when we come back. Yeah, Riley?
Yeah, that's right. This is Air America Radio.
Mark Maron and Mark Riley, Mornings Edition on Air America Radio.
Before past the hour, Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Good morning.
I had an interesting conversation with Kayla there for a second about cheeseburgers. I've grown to this point where I don't. He puts ketchup, A1 sauce on his. I don't put anything. I'll just eat a cheeseburger with just the cheese. Nothing. No ketchup. No nothing.
Just the cheese.
Just the cheese. Well, I put a bun, but I don't put anything on it because just I want to taste the things that are important. Sometimes overbearing the condiments. Anyways, not important. I love to eat. What can I tell you? Hey, since our president is openly operating in a different reality, we think it's important that Americans know what's happening in his alternate universe. Luckily, we have a staffer who lives in that world, and many of you know him. So now on the phone once again is Planet Bush correspondent Lawton Smalls. Good morning, Lawton.
Good morning, Mark. God got your personal retirement account, and he's going to privatize your soul.
Okay, very good.
Put it on the market.
Yes, sir. Okay. Today?
Go red.
All right. Today we're going to talk about President Bush's Social Security fear-mongering.
Oh, Mark.
Fear-mongering.
Social Security is a looming crisis.
Come on.
Do you hear what I'm saying to you? It's looming, Mark. Looming. That's practically Chinese. Looming dynasty.
All right. Listen.
I'm afraid.
All right.
You should be too.
No. It's a looming scam is what it is, Lawton. It's a Republican three-card Monte scheme to cut benefits and transfer protected Social Security money to the private sector. I mean, Social Security is the most successful government program in our nation's history, and yet it's the one program that the Bush bunch wants to destroy. What is that?
You know, success can be a trap, Mark, don't you think?
You
I mean, look at Elvis. Now, in his latter days,
Elvis,
the king was just like Social Security, bloated, sweaty, impervious to change or criticism, trapped in unflattering polyester jumpsuits.
Well, maybe
you doing things like Moody Blues.
You know what?
No one
you
likes
what?
That song.
Well, maybe that was the colonel's fault. What do you think of that?
Well, you know, you liberals are always blaming the military. But here's what I'm saying. If we don't stop feeding Social Security fried peanut butter and banana sandwiches, it's going to die on the toilet.
Wait a minute.
Elvis paid no attention to his looming crisis. Let's not make the same mistake with our future.
Well, look at me. I think this whole thing is just another way for Bush to rip off working-class Americans, and in this case, Lawton, my friend, senior citizens, ripping off the senior citizens.
Hang on, Mark.
What?
These days, seniors have it so good, they don't need government benefits anymore. Incredible discounts on food, entertainment, and transportation just for being old. Why, in this day and age, if an infirm elderly woman with cataracts and osteoporosis wants to take a bus across town to catch the afternoon matinee of Coach Carter, well, who's stopping her? I mean, if she wants an inexpensive supper, well, from what I understand, there are some very tasty brands of cat food.
Oh, that's awful. That's awful.
Fantastic. And then... Well, she can do twosies in her diaper, which you have to do. You know, she's on Easy Street. Why does a gal like that need Social Security?
First of all,
she does it.
Disgusting.
Out of time.
Disgusting. To justify Bush's Social Security con, is that what you keep telling yourself? You're just going to justify it? It's disgusting. Yeah, that's right. That's right.
That's what I keep telling my mama Gladys. She was counting on her Enron retirement plan for her golden years, and look what happened.
Your mama Enron?
I invested the rest of her life savings in the stock market, and she lost it all.
Oh.
I'm a fool.
Oh.
She raised a fool. I can't tell my poor mama. I've been making up the difference out of my own pocket. So Social Security gets privatized, I have nothing for my own retirement.
Oh.
I won't be able to see Coach Carter.
See?
I want to see that.
All right.
I love Sam Jackson.
So, okay, so,
great.
All right, so now,
all those kids just want to play basketball.
So now you can see how...
That's all?
So you can see how... I know. So you can see how Bush's Social Security proposal is screwed up, right? Well, you can see how it's screwed up now, right? You have some clarity, right? Some clarity. You all right?
Looming crisis.
Oh, come
that
on.
Is. Covered over at 500 feet
every
tall
time.
With sharp teeth.
Every
daggers
time.
For teeth. Oh. Looming.
Okay, all right.
Looming dynasty.
Okay, thank you, Lawton.
God loves you. Yeah. Deal with it. Looming crisis.
Okay, all right. Get off the phone. All right, enough. All right, goodbye. Unbelievable.
Wow.
Always the same with that guy. Sucks me in with the emotion. Bam. Get hit right in the head. All right, now on the phone with us. If I could, this book is, it looks very interesting. It's called The Marketplace of Revolution, How Consumer Politics Shaped American Independence. He is a William Smith Mason Professor of History at Northwestern University, and he is with us on the phone. T.H. Breen, good morning.
Hello, Mark.
Good morning.
Very nice to have you, sir. Would you please tell us, like, you know, give us a quick synopsis about how consumer politics, you know, played into the revolution in a succinct, brief way.
Well, I try to be succinct. Professors aren't always that way. But look, I was thinking about the American Revolution. There's a political problem then, and there is very similar to the one that we have today.
Mm-hmm.
And that is, how do you bring extraordinarily diverse men and women, ordinary people, together, mobilize them in a political protest? The protest then, obviously, against the British Empire. And so the books try to find some cultural resource that people could use to develop a sense of trust, mutuality, solidarity, whatever, that allowed them to affect a proper resistance against the empire.
Wait, a nonviolent resistance.
Hmm?
Is it a violent resistance initially?
No. Look, what the book argues is that before you can have a real infrastructure for resistance,
sure,
you have to have a sense of trust.
Mm-hmm.
And look, I mean, up and down the coast, we have 1,800 miles, no good roads. People, some have slaves, some don't. Some are Congregationalists, some are Catholics. Some raise tobacco, others raise pine tar. There was no reason to believe that these people could ever get together and mount a revolution. Or if they did mount a revolution, it might look like Latin America, you know, a series of separate countries.
Right.
So it's counterintuitive.
So what did they do?
What happened?
What did they do? How did the consumer politics unify them?
Well, I mean, everybody, all your listeners know about, you know, chucking the tea. into Boston Harbor.
Sure.
What they don't know is that that was sort of the end of a series of developing a totally new and I think quite exciting form of political protest, the consumer boycott.
Okay.
It began in the middle of the 1760s. At first, it was very primitive, rudimentary. People didn't trust one another, and they got a little better during the 1770 period.
How did that happen? Who pioneered this? Were the forefathers part of this? How did they unite all these people?
Well, let's see. That's one of the things that my work and my continuing work is trying to do. I'm trying to write a history of the American Revolution that kind of, shall we say, brackets the founding fathers. I've had quite enough of the founding fathers.
Sure.
I think what we need to get back to as liberals and Democrats is to think about ordinary people in politics and how to get them activated.
Sure.
So the burden of my book is to try to figure out how we're going to get these people on board. And this led me to a rediscovery that in the middle of the 18th century, in other words, before the Revolution, there had been a great consumer change, a shift. And so almost everybody by 1750 is doing what you and I do.
Mm-hmm.
They went to the store, they had credit, they bought their clothes, they bought their exciting stuff that made them feel pretty and sexy and successful. And so these people are already totally immersed into a vibrant Atlantic consumer marketplace. And what people hadn't seen is that out of this experience in this marketplace came the potential to develop a powerful new political weapon, the consumer boycott. These are the first people, Mark,
yes,
that ever used it. This is a totally new strategy against power.
And it was a unifying force that eventually led to the birth of America.
Well, look, yeah. I mean, look, in the newspapers at the time were sort of what the web would be today.
Sure.
Okay? And so you have people in Charleston, South Carolina, writing in the newspapers that we're boycotting, we're doing this and that. And the people in Massachusetts are reading it, and they say, well, we don't know if we like those guys and all that, but they seem to be doing what they're supposed to be doing. And out of these communications and these mutual declarations came a sense of trust. I mean, you could monitor.
Right. So there was a unification of people of all different classes, different colors, different backgrounds, different businesses around the idea that the way they could facilitate change and perhaps not get killed was to not buy things.
That's right.
So let's talk about.
I wouldn't push the color bit quite yet, but.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. But.
Yeah, because most of the folks of color over here at the time were slaves.
Right. They weren't.
You got it, especially in the South.
Well, let's talk about how this can take place today, because some of it does. You know, we have choosetheblue.com to find out who gives money where. You know, it was funny that when you said that they had credit cards and dressed sexy, I just had this moment in my head where I thought, you know, like George Washington, membership has its rewards, you know, like an American Express commercial, but obviously
right.
They didn't have.
You also get that new ad for one of the automobiles, an American Revolution.
Sure, sure.
Yeah, right.
Okay, well, we're talking to a Professor T.H. Breen. The book is The Marketplace of Revolution, How Consumer Politics Shaped American Independence. We're going to talk about the present day and how the power of this can change things now. It's 44 past the hour on Air America Radio.
Mark Maron and Mark Riley, because two marks
are better than one.
Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Past the hour. We're going to put this thing down. I'm Mark Maron. That's Mark Riley.
Yes, it is.
You've been listening to and are listening now to Morning Sedition on Air America Radio. Our guest on the phone, Professor T.H. Breen, the author of The Marketplace of Revolution, How Consumer Politics Shaped American Independence. Now, before we get into the current situation, Professor Breen, I want to know, just let's try to get at what was life like for these people at this time, the colonists, and what did they first boycott, and what effect did it have on England?
Yeah, look, Mark, I mean, I think most of the people that are listening to us, when they went to school, learned that the colonists were self-sufficient. They made all their stuff, they grew it, and blah, blah, blah. And it wasn't until the Industrial Revolution that factories started producing a consumer line of goods. What my book shows and what a lot of wonderful research by many other people show is that this consumer life predated the revolution. I mean, they were closer to us in many ways.
Sure.
All right, but so that does away with this kind of self-sufficient yeoman farmer myth that
okay.
is embedded in American history and a lot of, frankly, conservative history of the kind of people that do their own stuff. But, in fact, we went to the marketplace. And what did they boycott? Mark, by the 1760s, half of all cloth, cottons and wonderful colored striped goods. Half of all the cloth exported from England went to the 13 colonies.
Mm.
It was a huge amount. In other words, the very clothes that you wore were what I call in the book emblems of empire.
Wow.
Because they had a political quality, you see.
Sure.
If you begin to boycott the stuff that comes from the source of power,
mm-hmm.
You know, you can see immediately the political connection. The marketplace was politicized. It was part of an imperial relationship.
Sure. And they were going to come over. They could either, you know, take the hit or come over and force you to buy or try to plow you under.
Well, I mean, the British lawyers and whatnot, people in Parliament, called these boycott operations unlawful combinations. And
what does that mean?
Well, it means that ordinary people getting together on their own to effect a political end without any kind of authorization from people in power.
Yeah, who were they to not buy our stuff?
Yeah, right.
Yeah, so now
and organized to do so.
Okay, this is powerful stuff. Now, in today's world, you know, like we have a link on our website on morningsedition.com to choose the blue. There's
right.
a lot of people that, you know, not a day doesn't go by where I am not presented with, you know, the opportunity or the instigation to protest and not buy something by a company that is deemed evil for whatever reason. What effect does this have in the marketplace today?
Look, I mean, it's a very, very dangerous mark for historians to talk about the present. I mean, they usually make fools of themselves. All I know for sure is that by 1774, say on the eve of independence,
okay.
the colonists pretty successfully had closed down this marketplace.
Mm-hmm.
It worked. And if people today, if your listeners, you know, see the power of consumption, they see the political possibilities of their own pocketbook, they can achieve, I think, effective ends. They can get the attention of the red companies. But, look, a boycott is only a strategy.
Yeah.
But a political strategy without a vision is just simply a mere gesture. And that's what I worry about today. The people just make gestures. They kind of, you know, it's a way of giving the Republicans a little goof.
That's a good point.
Right. So these Americans in the Revolution, not only they boycotted, but they began, especially in the 1773-74 period, to envision a new republic that would be governed by the people, not by kings and aristocrats. So in order for us to mobilize today, we need to see political possibilities that are, you know, powerfully inviting.
Well, we also need to see that we have a king and an aristocrat.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, well, I mean, sure. I mean, you know, there's probably some parallels
mm-hmm.
between the King Georges.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, right. Now, to what extent, if at all, have various lawsuits against people who have called boycotts, specifically the NAACP? What do you think that's done as far as the boycott as a useful tool is concerned?
Well, I think if people want to use the cultural and economic resources that they have in their ordinary lives, they'll do it. I mean, if you think these lawsuits discourage people, I don't know. My guess is that's not where the problem is. The problem is in the will and the willingness to sacrifice for a political cause.
Interesting. Well, it's great talking to you, Professor Breen. T.H. Breen, the book is The Marketplace of Revolution, How Consumer Politics Shaped American Independence. It's available on our website for a small discount at morningsedition.com. I really appreciate you being here. Nice talking to you, sir.
It's been great.
Take care.
You take care. So that's pretty interesting. You know, this is obviously, you know, it's pretty dense historical stuff. There's a lot of research in this. And I kind of feel stupid with this stuff because I was not a good history student.
No, let me tell you something. I agree with this fundamental premise mm-hmm. that if people are a lot more discriminating about what they buy and from whom, that it can, in fact, have an impact. And if that kind of activity is organized, it will have an even larger impact.
It has to. The whole world is fueled by this.
But I disagree with him about the fact that the aggressive resistance to boycotts, particularly in the South, that it has not had an effect on boycotts overall.
Mm-hmm.
Because the bottom line is the NAACP and other organizations have tried boycotts on many different occasions, and the minute they start to become successful, whoever their target is sues,
mm-hmm.
saying that they're restraining people's ability to do business, they're restricting interstate mm-hmm. commerce, they got all kinds of reasons.
The poor victim corporations.
Yeah.
Corporations, the victimized purveyors of products.
Yeah, and in many instances, it ends up being a situation where there's an negotiated summit. I refused, for example, to stay in an Adams Mark hotel when I had the opportunity to a few years ago because the NAACP was boycotting the hotel. Now, it ended up in a situation where Adams Mark, I believe, sued the NAACP. This is in 2001. And they ended up, you know, negotiating an agreement. But Adams Mark also, and this is the same thing Walmart's doing, they used an aggressive PR campaign to portray themselves as good corporate citizens, and that always can break the back of a boycott if people aren't careful.
Yeah, but if you do what he says and you stay the course and you keep the word of mouth campaign going, what the hell can they sue you for?
Easier said than done. They can sue your organization.
That, but
they
I understand.
Can, yeah, they can't sue you as an individual.
No, I know, but I mean, okay, so the organization in no longer, you know, it has these tenets where they say not to do something. But within the community, if that stuff sticks,
oh, yeah.
you can't do
sticks,
anything
it
about
sticks.
It. Yeah, right. Well, there's a liberal agenda for today. Here are your marching orders from the Streisand compound. One, anytime someone asks if you're going to watch the inauguration, say, I already saw the screening. It sucked. Two, name change. Fat Albert to plus-sized Albert. Three, John Dean's campaign to become DNC chairman. Throw your whole heart and soul into it, then wait to be bitterly disappointed. Four, as a distraction from the inauguration, start to care deeply about the Oscar nominations. And five, today's phrase, if someone asks you why you're wearing a dashiki and not at work, say, some people observe Martin Luther King weak, man, weak. Wake up, sheeple. Wake up.
There you go.
So we got Jim Moore tomorrow?
We got Jim Moore tomorrow. That's going to be a lot of fun. We're counting down to the election. I guess that'd
be election.
The
Iraqi
election. The Iraqi election and the Bush coronation, or
okay.
whatever that's going to be on Thursday.
The
we're going to deal with all of this tomorrow here on Air America Radio. Have a good one, Maren.
You too, man.
Mark Maron and Mark Riley, Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.